So basically what you're saying is kids are the cause of COVID right now, and we need to take harsh action to correct the problem, if I've understood correctly.
You're definitely not understanding correctly, but yes. Okay.
Pediatrician calls for the culling of our children.
Stop having sex, people. We need to stop producing children to end disease.
It's a show about medicine.
Please wear a mask while listening.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead, jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is
called... Wait, no, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Dr. Olivier Drouin. He is a pediatrician and clinician scientist at the Division of General Pediatrics at Saint-Justin Hospital, the largest mother and child center in Canada, located right here in Montreal. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Montreal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And as you told us, and just to clarify for our Quebec listeners, you are not the founder of the COVID École Québec or COVID Quebec Schools initiative, which was started by another Olivier Drouin, but not you, correct?
That is correct.
I am shocked. What? I'm very upset by this revelation.
I unfortunately don't have his contact info, so I cannot put you in touch. But no, the other Olivier Drouin is in charge of COVID École is a man who did great work. He's a dad and he's not a doctor. And although I am a dad, I am a doctor. So we're not the same person.
And is one of you going to be changing your name soon just to avoid future issues?
I've been hoping for the last 12 months that he's going to fade into he's going to disappear from public space and I'm going to be the only one. It just didn't occur yet. So I'm still keeping the fight.
How are you with wielding a sword? Because as Highlander taught us, there can only be one. So maybe it might come to that, a sword fight somewhere. But anyway, so now that we've corrected the record, I guess we should begin by addressing the most foundational misconception when it comes to discussions of COVID in kids. Because some people have argued since the beginning of the pandemic that basically COVID doesn't affect children, right? They are essentially immune to it. And sure, a few of them get it and a few of them get sick and maybe they die, but they probably had pre-existing conditions. And basically, this argument is part of the larger position that COVID is only bad for elderly people who have diabetes and heart problems. So what do you say to people who believe that COVID just doesn't affect children and we just shouldn't worry about it?
It is a very difficult position to hold the truth with regards to the impact of COVID in children. And unfortunately, I think people on both sides of the spectrum tend to take mental shortcuts. As an aside, that's part of my research interest is behavioral science, how people use cognitive shortcuts in their decision and their risk assessment. And so I think it is correct to say that the vast majority of children who will get infected with SARS-CoV-2, the virus causing COVID-19, will do very well. The majority of children who do get infected will have either asymptomatic disease or very mild disease that will not necessitate contact with the health services. However, because something is rare doesn't mean it does not exist. And I've definitely treated children who required hospitalization, required intensive care unit care, and those children are real. And if you talk to those families, as I did, they sure hope that their kid didn't get COVID. And yes, many of them had, unfortunately, comorbid conditions that lended them to have more severe disease. There are some children that were perfectly healthy before that occurred and that suffered, severe complications from either the infection itself or what's called the pediatric multi-inflammatory syndrome, multi-organ inflammatory syndrome. that follows the infection. So bottom line, rare, severe complications, but rare doesn't equal zero.
No, I was going to say, are you seeing more complications like traditional COVID disease in children, or are children coming to hospital with the MISC, the multisystem inflammatory syndrome?
Yeah, so I'm part of an initiative with pediatrician and pediatric providers from across the country, and we prospectively sought cases of both MISC and acute COVID infections from the beginning of a pandemic until May 2021. And interestingly, the number of kids that were hospitalized with either of those conditions was the same. So we had a few hundred cases, both hospitalized with acute COVID-19, and a few hundred that were hospitalized with MISC.
In Quebec, for the whole province?
In Canada.
In Canada, wow, okay. Are there risk factors in children that increase their chances of getting a severe enough form of COVID that they end up in the hospital?
Yes. So first, obvious one is age. So children, very, very young infants, so in the first month or two of life, tends to have more severe disease than other ones. At the other end of the spectrum, adolescents tend to have more severe disease than school-age children and preschool-age kids. So that's number one. Number two, presence of any chronic comorbid condition is a risk factor. And when we dig a bit deeper into which one those are, the big three categories are obesity, neurological conditions. So children often that have, cerebral palsy, seizure disorder, other kind of neurological conditions. And the last one is chronic lung conditions that were, significant in terms of their impact on daily living. So specifically asthma, which is the most common chronic disease of kids, children with controlled asthma, same risk as general population. Uncontrolled asthma or cystic fibrosis or other severe respiratory disease, definitely a risk factor for more severe infection with COVID-19.
You mentioned some neurological conditions as a risk factor for severe disease. Do we know what the mechanism might be? Because, of course, it makes sense if you have some kind of respiratory issue that you throw in a respiratory virus in there, it's going to make things worse. But I'm a little bit sort of taken aback by this association with neurological conditions. Do we have an idea of what's happening there?
Yeah, they tend not to be children with, they're not kids with only migraines. They're not children with mild condition. They're not kids with learning disabilities or, mild neurological disease. We're talking about children who are not able to conduct their activity of daily living. They're not able to go to school or get dressed by themselves because their neurological conditions is severe enough that they require help. And so often we see those children as having difficulty clearing their airways. They are more at risk of, coughing or swallowing difficulties. And so those children are just more sick. So they're very kind of, they're often wheelchair bound or, children with mostly developmental disorder, but of neurological origin.
Okay. You've used the word comorbidity, and I want to throw this at Chris just to make sure that our listeners understand what a comorbidity is. We often throw that term around, but what is it exactly?
It's basically any pre-existing medical condition that exists alongside the primary disease that you're talking about. So the primary disease here is COVID. A comorbidity is a disease that exists in parallel with that. It is a morbidity that is sort of a partner to it. So the ones in adults that have made the biggest difference epidemiologically are high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity as well. So it's things that would generally put you in a weaker state of health and make you more susceptible to severe complications of COVID.
Olivier, I was wondering, are there differences? I mean, now of course, we're in the middle of this Omicron wave. And so I'm curious to know if there are differences in how the Omicron variant affects children compared to Delta or to previous variants. I saw some recent numbers that Quebec hospitals used to get 4 to 5 young patients with COVID every week. But during the first week of January, that went up, from 4 to 5 to 42. Mm-hmm. although many of them were admitted for other reasons, and then they tested positive upon admission. So has the landscape changed with Omicron with regards to kids?
And basically, is the old joke no longer true? It used to, the joke was that the pediatric ICUs were empty and the pediatricians were sitting around. In May of 2020 or March of 2020, pediatricians were sitting around with nothing to do, and they were putting adult patients in the pediatric ICUs, and I'm guessing that is... no longer the situation at this
point. And pediatricians were going, wow, our patients are so much bigger now. Yeah. I don't understand.
So, yes. So definitely, especially at St. Justin, we did prepare back in the days to welcome adult patients. Very few actually ended up in the ICU in reality. The biggest change with Omicron is the fact that, yeah, we do have more children that are hospitalized with a positive test. This is not because the disease is more severe in children. There are just more of them. So the fraction hasn't changed, but the denominator has increased, and therefore the numerator has increased. So given that there are more, let's use hypothetical figure, if, you know, out of 1,000 children, who get COVID, one gets hospitalized. Well, if you have 2,000 cases, you're going to have two kids hospitalized. If you have 20,000 cases, you're going to have 20 patients hospitalized. So basically what we're seeing, the disease is not that different. It's definitely not more severe. There's just a whole lot more of it.
Yeah, it's more contagious, so it reaches more people and puts more people in the hospital just by its contagiousness.
Is the fact that children are still represent the largest unvaccinated group, is that why we're seeing, or the suggestion that we're seeing, a proportionally higher number of kids getting sick? Is that just the main explanation as far as you can see?
Yeah, I mean, they're just, so the virus doesn't seem to have any predilection for kids, but it definitely has predilection for populations that are not vaccinated. And, you know, kids have two big risk factors. The first one is that they're not vaccinated, or they're not adequately vaccinated for the vast majority at the moment. The second one is that, you know, right until the holidays, they were by far a segment of the population who had the most frequent and greater number of contacts from people outside their household. So whereas many people were working from home and or be in contact with people who were already vaccinated. Obviously, if you have a three-year-old going to daycare, that three-year-old is very likely to have a lot of contacts with a lot of unvaccinated kids with, you know, very little useful preventive measures in place. Like, those kids cannot wear masks very well. They share a lot of germs. I do not teach anything to your parent listener at the moment, but yeah, it's both the fact that they're not vaccinated and the fact that they have a lot more contacts.
So basically what you're saying is kids are the cause of COVID right now, and we need to take harsh action to correct the problem, if I've understood correctly.
You're definitely not understanding correctly, but yes. Okay.
Pediatrician calls for the culling of our children.
Stop having sex, people. We need to stop producing children to end disease.
Says the guy who started COVID. Yeah, exactly. have you looked at I saw this recently. I haven't looked into it very deeply. Have you looked at the recent claim that people under the age of 18 were at an increased risk of being diagnosed with diabetes after a COVID infection?
I have seen that. In all honesty, I have not read the... Because as you probably very well know, the headline versus the actual scientific peer-reviewed paper are often in two different worlds. So I have not read the peer-reviewed scientific publication. So I'm not sure what's the mechanism there. I can tell you that there's been deep interest in the pediatric community to look at side effects of both the pandemic as well as public health measures. And I think there were a lot of concerns about delayed presentation of disease or like ripple effect of the pandemic. For example, we've seen that there's been huge negative trends towards with regards to lifestyle behaviors. So, you know, as a risk factor for type 2 diabetes, you know, children have increased their screen time like there's no tomorrow. Physical activity has plummeted. Kids are sitting next to their fridge much more than they used to. And so there's been increase in obesity rates, definitely since the beginning of the pandemic. So that's for type 2. So what people tend to refer to as, you know, adult diabetes. For type 1 diabetes, we don't know what causes type 1 diabetes. So is there an infectious component? Possibly. I mean, those are the two hypotheses that I could see, but I didn't read the details.
I mean, I guess the theory would be that the virus is causing damage and attacking the islet cells of the pancreas. That would be the mechanism if you wanted to posit that's the case, but it's an association, right? It's not a necessarily causative thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, and as I said, like for all the autoimmune diseases out there, even pre-COVID, we don't know what's the, you know, mechanism for why it starts and when it starts. And there has been some association between infection and first presentation of type 1 diabetes before COVID. So is that the case here? Possibly.
Or as you alluded to, a possible delay in getting a diagnosis because of COVID, and now they all come in at the same time. Although we're only speculating because you haven't read the paper, Chris, right?
I read it. I looked at it very, very briefly. So I haven't had the time to get into it.
Okay. Let's talk about vaccines, because there's also been significant pushback against vaccinating children. And the argument is always, well, you know, COVID is mild in children, but the vaccine is very, very risky. And we're going to give myocarditis to all of our children. So what do we know about the safety of the approved COVID vaccines in children?
The safety profile of vaccines that are approved at the moment. So those are the mRNA vaccine of two companies that will not name, that everyone knows, is extremely good. The concerns were mostly around inflammation of the heart. So you mentioned myocarditis, so myocarditis and pericarditis, so inflammation itis of either the muscle. I'm talking to a cardiologist. I don't even know why I say that, but
no, but this is great because some of our listeners may not know. Yes, I mean, we've explained those terms on the show before, but we may have listeners who haven't listened to those episodes. So yes, do explain this. Myocarditis, itis, inflammation, or infection sometimes, as we've mentioned before on the show, Chris. Sometimes it's confusing.
Yes, yeah, either the muscle part of the heart or the envelope of the heart. And so those are true potential complications of the vaccinations. Those were initially detected in young adults. So, you know, when the vaccine was not yet available to under 18. So they were detected in 18 to 30 year olds, more males and females. And obviously that raised a lot of concerns in the US initially and then in Canada about the potential effect on kids. And so when the vaccine was approved for the 12 to 17 year olds, we did see a certain number of those of myocarditis and pericarditis in teenagers. The rate is debatable, depends by studies, but we're talking about a few, like I've seen figures between 5 and 30 cases per 100,000 doses administered. And that's what we've seen in teenagers. Now, when the vaccine was approved for primary school age kids, there was a lot of concerns, but we had very little data as to like what would be the rate in kids. And data came out from the CDC, I think last week or the week before, and the rate is much lower in school age kids. So I think all of this came from a good place, i.e. we wanted to make sure that we were not harming children by giving them this vaccine. However, and I think, unfortunately, the consequence that it had is that it led to a lot of parents, but also policymakers and even scientists to put a weaker recommendations for vaccination of the 5 to 11 versus the other age group because of that concern around myo and pericarditis, which I think in retrospect, was probably overblown. And the last thing I will add to that is that even though all of this sounds extremely scary, a young teenager previously well having myocarditis, having cared for them, for some of them, I can tell you that you know, within 12 hours having them in Jaspel, we were like, okay, so when can we send them home again? Like, they were they were doing very well. We gave them basically Tylenol, Advil, and watch them for 24, 48 hours and send them home. And, you know, from the scientific reports that are out there, evolution extremely favorable after diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, myocarditis has become like a boogie word, if I may use that phrase, among the anti-vaxxers, scaring parents who probably don't really know what myocarditis is. It's just, it's a complicated word. It sounds really bad. You don't want your kid to have it. But as you pointed out, it's really not the end of the world. And Chris, as a cardiologist, you can weigh in. I mean, it's, and it happens all the time.
Well, I mean, what's very bizarre, not bizarre, but it, like, you had a lot, like, not a lot, but you had some physicians who were very opposed to vaccinating children because of this issue. And it, and some cardiologists too, and they would say things like, you know, until you've seen a kid have to go on ECMO because of a fulminant myocarditis, and you're like, sure, if they have, you know, giant cell or something. I mean, it's like a viral myocarditis is rarely this severe, and most cases are benign. Like, once you've done your 20th consult for a person with atypical chest pain that's kind of positional, and you're like, okay, maybe it's pericarditis, but like all the biomarkers are negative or the CRP is a bit elevated, and you're like, look, here, take some colchicine for 3 months and I'll, you know, normal echo. It's like, it was surprising to me to see how worried people got about a condition that is usually very benign. It's not to say that there aren't severe cases of it, but they are very rare, and usually because of something like really underlying, like an underlying disease, not like the idiopathic pericarditis, myocarditis that we see sort of all the time.
I think it has to do with the, you know, if I put myself in the shoes of a parent, I'm not a parent, but this
and whose fault is that, Jonathan? Whose fault is that?
I'm very happy to not be a parent, but it's this idea that, like, you don't want anything bad to happen to your kid, and when somebody says, well, your kid will need to have something injected into them, you're worried about what this may mean to your kid. You don't want to harm your kid, and so you are predisposed to latching onto anything that you hear about that is scary. And of course, if those promoters, these fear mongers, use an extreme example, as you just mentioned, Chris, of like, oh, there, he's on an ECMO machine now because of a case of myocarditis, to represent the average, then of course it sounds very, very scary, but it's all very irrational. I mean, it starts from a good place, but it becomes an irrational argument.
Yeah, I think two quick things I'll piggyback on this. I think the first one is people, and that includes physicians and includes scientists, are really bad with, you know, we latch to numerators, we latch to the number who have them, and we completely forget or neglect how many people got vaccinated. Like, how many people actually did just well after vaccination? And so we talk about those few cases, that identifiable victim that the behavioral scientists call, like, we can put a name on that child, and we interviewed, like, on prime time TV, like, the parent of one child who got, like, bad myocarditis.
This is Melody. She was fine until she got the vaccine. Now look at her face.
No, but I mean, that's
yeah, that, denominator, that's just, neglect.
It's very powerful. And then the other thing is that there's good data on this. When you start talking, especially in graphic term, about a condition, the frequency of the condition or frequency of that side effect just goes out the window. People focus on what it is rather than how frequent it is. And obviously both sides of the equations are important. But just our brain tends to latch to one and, you know, let go of the other.
Melody's heart was never the same afterwards. Well, speaking of all of this, have you, Olivier, have you spoken to parents who were hesitant to vaccinate their kids?
I haven't spoken to any in the last 24 hours, but before that, yes.
Okay. How did that go? What were, I mean, generally speaking, without having any sort of identifying information, but like, what were their concerns? What had they heard? And did you see examples of exactly what you describe, of people neglecting the denominator and focusing on those rare events and blowing them out of proportion because of what they had heard or read?
Yes. I mean, the majority, so many parents have questions. Many of them are extremely reasonable in their questions. And, you know, parents just want the best for their kids. And we tend to be more risk tolerant towards ourselves than towards our kids. So we tend to be more risk averse when it comes to the life of our children. So we want to make sure that we, you know, make the right decision. Most parents that are hesitant, it's a variation on the two themes that we just mentioned. The first one is that, is it necessary, given that many kids, the majority of kids are doing fine? And the other is, what about the side effects? And are they real? And are they frequent? And how bad are they? And it's really, parents are doing a very rational, weighing the risk and benefits of vaccinating. And they have incomplete information, partly because the sources of credible information exist, but they're also overwhelmed and overpowered sometimes by less credible.
You can say Joe Mercola if you want.
People who have a non-monogamous relationship with the truth.
Unfortunately, it's really easy, and those people, fearmongers and provider of misinformation, unfortunately, are smart. And they know how to exploit people's doubts and way of thinking. And they do exactly that. They exploit it. And so it's much easier to do that than to try to have a nuanced conversation and to give, you know, possibly incomplete or to false certainties, I think. I tend to be very open with the families I talk to about what we know, what we don't know, that the risks are not zero, but they're very small. And this is complicated stuff. I mean, like, some of my pediatric residents have a hard time, like, grasping some of those concepts, and parents need to integrate them. So I think that comes from a good place at the end of the day, but those people are unfortunately, because of different channel of communications, are exposed to a lot of misinformation, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're very statistically challenged as a species. We're not very good with numbers and risk assessment.
It's true. 85% of people know that.
And those misinformers that we were mentioning, I mean, it seems that what they do is that they play with two pairs of scales, where they will reduce the risk of the disease, they will increase the risk of the vaccine, and they will bring down the benefit of the vaccine. So they will sell the vaccine as not being that effective anyway, and the risks are very, very high, but COVID is not a big deal anyway. And so if that's where you're getting your news from, you're getting a very, very artificially skewed perspective on this risk-benefit calculation.
And that is when they're not actually doing the, you know, they're not walking, what is the expression? Anyway, that's when they're not seeing something different than what they're doing. So many of those people are actually vaccinated themselves.
It's called hypocrisy, Olivier. Yeah, like Tucker Carlson, who works at Fox News, who has to be vaccinated, and then he's there on the air every evening railing against vaccines. Let's talk about schools, even though you're not the guy behind the COVID cut thing, but let's talk about schools, because that has proven to be very, very divisive during the pandemic. Some will say that schools must remain open because the mental toll of virtual classes is just untenable for both children and for parents. Others see the opening of schools as being very risky when cases skyrocket, and they worry about A, children getting sick, with some ending up in the hospital, but also B, children transmitting the virus to teachers, to staff, to parents. Chris, maybe you can give us, like, at the time of recording, what is happening with our schools right now in Quebec? I mean, they're virtual, but they're on the verge of maybe reopening. We're not sure.
Well, the plan is for them to reopen on Monday. So next week, where it's going to return to in-person learning. Whether, you know, how broad that is, I think remains to be seen. There is some question about the CGEPs and the university. So CGEPs being the junior college system that we have here in Quebec. So there, I think there's some discussion that might happen for you know, the older students, so people over the age of 18. But for elementaries and high schools, the plan as of now is for them to all get back to in-person learning on Monday.
So, Olivier, as a pediatrician, where do you fall on that spectrum of risk benefits of in-person school and the measures that have or have not been implemented in schools in order to make the space safer? What are your thoughts on this?
First thing I would say is always be careful of people who are on the extremes, on either side. And I personally get criticized from people on both sides. So that's, I think, the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing is, there's no doubt in my mind, and I think that's where many of the pediatricians come from, that school is important, that school plays a very important role in the life of children, and that not providing them with in-person school is associated and probably cause a lot of very negative and widespread side effects. We mentioned briefly prior the impact on, you know, physical activity for some low-income children. Facilities accessible at school are the only occasion they have to do physical activity. We've seen huge spikes in mental health problems from teenagers, but also school age, primary school age kids with remote learning and isolation. There's definite impact on learning. We know, you know, especially for everyone, you know, distance learning is harder than in-person learning. It's even worse for kids with learning disabilities who normally access those resources through school that are not available when they are schooled from home. So on one side, it is clear that in-person learning is better than remote learning. However, in addition to my hat as a pediatrician, I happen to be, you know, to have a master's in public health and doing research in health services. I cannot turn my head and not see how difficult the situation is in hospitals right now across Quebec. There are many hospitals are faced with very difficult decisions regarding allocation of resources, including human resources. There's a record number. I think the current figure is 20,000 healthcare workers that are not at work at the moment. It's frightening. I think we're down to making very difficult choices. We have a curfew. We are very limited in number of contacts we can have. You know, increasing number of people who have contacts with each other does come at a cost. And so I think we need to weigh those two things. And it's not easy, but I think it should be done. And there's ways to make it safer. And so when it comes to solution, I think many of those solutions do exist. They just need to be ramped up. The first one, obviously, being ventilation in the schools. I mean, that's been a problem even before the pandemic. It's been identified as an issue for like 20 months. What have we done? I mean, Ontario has done a decent job. Quebec has done very little to improve ventilation in schools, like opening windows. Like, it was minus 35 yesterday morning. Like, who are we kidding? I think rapid tests, like, again, like, it's been available for a while. They're very difficult to access for families. I think vaccination should be a no-brainer for like both teachers and kids. And we talked about it, you know, before. I think there are solutions, contact tracing. I think there are solutions to make in-person school safe. And unfortunately, even though I want kids to go back to school, I do want them to go back to school in a safe environment. And I'm not quite seeing that at play at the moment in the announcement that I've been made.
Do you have any sense as to why ventilation became the divisive issue that it did? Because I would say, and you can disagree with me if you want, I think that for the most part...
I disagree.
Yeah, I know. For the most part, I think the government did relatively well with most things given the information they had at the time. But with schools and specifically with ventilation, I genuinely don't understand why there was this often antagonism with the schools and the parents, the government sort of insistence that no, ventilation was not, it's fine, we don't need to do it. And it was very, when you watch the story from a distance, it was very strange. It was very strange to understand why the government was taking the position it did, why it got angry when schools like themselves decided to buy air filtration units and install them. It was like, do you have a sense as to why ventilation became this argument, whereas all the other stuff really didn't? I mean, we can argue that the government didn't maybe ramp things up as quickly as they could have, but like, why this resistance to ventilation? Like, it really has baffled me as a concept.
I have part of an answer, but I'm curious to hear from Olivier first.
Yeah, I think, so I don't have the, I'm not a political analyst, but I think it has to do more
good
with
for
politics.
You. Good for you.
Yeah, exactly. I think it has more to do with politics than it has to do with public health or with medicine. But I think it comes from, so there's a concept in behavioral science we call cognitive dissonance, which is, it's really hard to hold in your head two positions that are in contradiction with each other. So it's really hard, and so you can have that at the individual level, or you can have it at the organization level, like the government. So it's really hard to say, you know, poor ventilation is bad for COVID transmission, and we have poor ventilation in schools, but we're doing everything we can. So I think at some point something needs to give. So I'm either like really doing everything I can, but why wouldn't I change ventilation? So I think when we cannot address the problem that caused the cognitive dissonance, our tendency is to do what? Is to change one of the thought that we have in our mind. So, you know, ventilation is bad, we're not fixing it. Therefore, it must be that ventilation is not a problem because we're doing everything we can. And I think whether it's conscious or unconscious, I'm not sure. But I think the reason why the government has kept on negating the impact of poor ventilation in schools is because they just cannot fix it. And I think it would cost a lot. I think it would require a lot of effort. And for whatever reason, they're not willing to go there. So rather than saying that, because obviously it would cause quite an uproar and people will say, well, I mean, if it's that bad, just fix it. They're negating the problem.
So I've been speaking to a few aerosol scientists for a piece that should be out by the time this episode drops. It's going to be at mcgill.ca/OSS about this whole COVID is airborne and ventilation, filtration thing. Because it's not just in Quebec that there's been this denialism of the airborne nature of SARS-CoV-2. This was at the level of the WHO, the World Health Organization. And it's a fascinating story because it goes back to bad air, right? To miasma theory that was in vogue for centuries, this idea that diseases were being carried in bad air. And then there was a reversal of that dogma. And people started to think about droplets and about surfaces. And that became the big thing. And so miasma was seen as being antiquated. And some early work there kind of informed a lot of medicine about how infectious diseases can even spread. And so there was a lot of resistance to the idea that diseases could be spread in an airborne fashion, as aerosols that hang in the air a bit like smoke for a little while. And so here and there you had a disease where, you know, like tuberculosis, it was shown with there was a guinea pig experiment using ultraviolet light to treat the air coming in from the wards to the guinea pigs. So here and there, there were some diseases where people had to realize like, okay, I guess this one is airborne, but the rest aren't. It's just droplets. And that became kind of a dogma in medicine, it seems. And those aerosol scientists are just so frustrated. And there have been many pieces written about this and about discussions that they had with the WHO. And they were angry at the aerosol scientists for even saying that SARS-CoV-2 might even be airborne, even though we had some super spreader events that were very difficult to explain otherwise. And you know, so the reason is this dogma, but it's also the fact that it's a lot easier to put the onus of responsibility on the individual people. Like, wear your mask, keep your distances. We're not going to fix a problem systematically because, as you pointed out, Olivier, like it requires a certain investment. You know, if the schools are not providing good air, then it is up to the schools and up to the government to provide resources to fix that situation. It's much easier to tell people, go buy your mask and wear your mask. And if you fall sick, well, I guess it's your fault.
It's almost
there's all of this. Yeah,
it's almost as if nailing the window shut in schools was a long-term negative plan for some reason.
Was it to prevent suicides? Like, I'm very curious.
No, it was. I mean, the rationale was, yeah, what if kids open the windows and fall out, right? Mm, so it was like, okay, I'm just going to seal them shut so they can't open. And it's like, oh, okay, that was potentially a short-sighted thing. But it's also weird, though, because I don't want to let this go, but it was like, if the furnace was like malfunctioning and there was a carbon monoxide leak, nobody would be arguing about it. It'd be like, yeah, okay, we understand. We've got to improve the air circulation system in the school. We got to update it. Like, there wouldn't be an argument, but there's this remarkable reluctance. And I don't know, maybe, Olivier, I think you're right. It's probably just they looked at things like, geez, we don't have $3 billion to spend on updating school infrastructure in the province. So let's try to change the channel on this conversation because we don't have the money right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, look at this shiny thing there. Like, don't talk about this. Like, we can, this is a problem we can fix. So let's focus on that problem and, like, let's not talk about the problem we cannot fix, you know?
Well, I mean, it's also, I mean, related, not to get too far off topic, but, like, some of the older hospitals don't have centralized air conditioning, right? And they get really hot in the summer. And the government knows is like, there's no way to put central air conditioning in some of these buildings. So it's either like build a new hospital or, you know, a bunch of portable air conditioning units, which is not, that costs a lot in terms of electricity. So like, it's bizarre. Yeah, I mean, I it's probably just an infrastructure issue, and hopefully it gets resolved over the generational cycles to come where we build new hospitals at some point.
Although, I mean, in terms of filtration, not ventilation, but filtration, it's fairly easy to filtrate aerosols out using these Corsi Rosenthal boxes, which are these kind of homemade boxes of filters with a fan, and they've been shown to work really, really well, and people can make them themselves. And that's what aerosol scientists are like screaming to anybody who will listen to them. Like, you can build those, you can bring them into schools, but some schools just don't want them there because they don't look, they're not bought, they don't have HEPA filters necessarily. And so now they're worried about this kind of like homemade, you know, dingy looking thing, and they don't realize that actually, no, this could actually work really well. Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, Olivier, I know you're not a pundit, but do you think that our elected leaders have enough of a grasp on science to handle a public health crisis like this?
No. Okay. No, but I mean, like, that's not their job, like, to be honest.
Right.
Like, you know, I it's like everyone who does politics in their living room, you know, like, it looks easy until it's not. Like, and you know, elected officials like the Minister of Health, there's no degree requirement to become a Minister of Health, and there's definitely no to become none. There's no public health, mandatory public health training to become like the Premier, or, like the Prime Minister. Like, and I don't think that it's necessary. I think what is required, would be required, is a basic understanding of statistics. I think their capacity to understand information that's presented to them, you know, is important. But I think the failure here is not an individual failure, but it's rather like, I think we need, and that's been called in the last few days, I think we need some independent assessment of the situation by credible scientists from different areas of life. So if you need virologists and epidemiologists, but also need economists and social scientists to make that decision, because it's a multifaceted decision about whatever, like returning to school and shortening isolation period and whatever, then let's convene this group. Let's have them debate and come up with recommendations and have that information available for scrutiny by journalists and by independent media, and have, you know, the government decide based on that. I think the problem that we're encountering now, and that's eroding, unfortunately, public confidence in the institutions, is that there's unclear division between the scientific aspect and the public health aspect of the pandemic with the politics aspect of the pandemic. And it's not always clear whether we're finding public health explanation for a political decision or whether a political decision is based on true science. And, you know, which way that arrow goes, I think is very important, but definitely not clear at the moment.
It's an interesting problem because there is, you know, an economic argument to be had when you're talking about lockdowns and when you shut things down. And there obviously is an economic impact. Now, when you're talking about the healthcare system being overwhelmed, I think most people would agree that the healthcare system has to take precedence in the short term. But it's not always an easy question, especially when we were in the summer and people are like, well, can we reopen dance clubs? And it's like, maybe, like, you know, it would, from the public health standpoint, it would be better if you didn't have a bunch of people maskless grinding up against each other in a club, but the risk is low, there's an economic impact. Like, where's the balance? And it's interesting that we tend to see these things as siloed conversations. Okay, let's talk about the health aspect, let's talk about the economic aspect, and then let's throw it all into a blender and the premier will decide and will, you know, take credit if things go well and, you know, presumably blame somebody else if things go badly. But
you think that would happen?
Nah, maybe. Actually, funny story. I was talking to somebody in British Columbia. The premier of British Columbia, apparently, and I mean, I don't watch the news there, but apparently, very rarely gives a press conference on COVID. Right? He just puts the public health director out, and they're like, "Go ahead, tell people what they need to hear. I'm going to be doing something else. I'm not getting involved in this. You tell people what your recommendations are, and you know, whatever happens." And it's an interesting approach because it's not the, I think, the instinct of politicians. Politicians want to be seen to be in control of the situation, and so will involve themselves in it. And the public sort of expects them of it. Like, there was a lot of talk about, like, you know, what is Trudeau doing for this? And a lot of people were like, well, you know, the federal government doesn't actually have much of a role to play in public health. Whether they should or not is a different discussion. But the federal government doesn't have much to do beyond ordering vaccines, ordering public tests, and, like, screening at the airports. I mean, there's not that much else. And yet, people are like, why is the federal government not showing leadership? And my response has always been, like, on what? what can they do beyond, you know, procurement, which is actually a pretty important thing, but it's like they don't have much of a role, and yet we still wait and see these like federal press conferences, which are usually, I think, not of much substance.
You recently tweeted out, Olivier, that you were hoping to move beyond doing research on COVID in 2022, but that it looks like that might have to be pushed back by another year. What are you actually looking forward to studying beyond COVID?
Yes.
Puppies? Puppies?
What's that?
Puppies?
Puppies? Yeah, puppies would be great. No, so my research, my non-COVID research, and my COVID research to some extent, is really an intersect between general pediatrics, public health, and what I hinted to as behavioral science. So in layman's term, is how people think about their health and how they navigate the healthcare system. And how can we better design healthcare system that for humans that have, you know, limited attention span and make imperfect decisions rather than people who, you know, are perfect decision makers. And, you know, there's tons of ways in which healthcare can be improved with regards to that. I just recently started a study looking at adherence to medication, for example. So, you know, on paper, adherence to medication is a no-brainer. Like in asthma, which is a disease that I study, you know, medication have excellent side effect profiles. They're fairly cheap. They prevent hospitalization. They prevent, like, tons of negative side effects, and people don't take them. Like, what's wrong with them? But the reality is that it's really hard for people to think about and justify taking treatment that, you know, if I take them, maybe it's going to help, maybe it's not going to help. If I don't take them, I don't feel any differently. I don't feel worse today. I'm trying to prevent something that may or may not happen 10 years down the road. Like, it's really hard cognitively to come up with a justification. And that is, like, on top of that, you administer that to a child who doesn't like the procedure. And so trying to find innovative ways to promote mitigation adherence, but that meets people where they are rather than, you know, being patronizing about their adherence. The other field that I do a lot of work in that along the same line is, you know, lifestyle behavior. So physical activity, nutrition, screen time, sleep. Those are no-brainers. Like, if there's like there's no field in medicine where there's more evidence of the benefits of something than physical activity. It prevents everything. It's good for mental health. It's good for stroke. It's good for like cancer. It's like, why aren't people doing it? But they're like, but
it's effortful. It's not a pill that I get to pop in. I have to move. I have to suffer.
Yeah. Exactly. But then we tend to, you know, especially in clinical medicine, we tend to have a very patronizing approach to people doing the physical activity. We basically just tell them, you should do more. Like, you're like, why don't you do more? Like, it's bad for you. You're going to die. And I mean, isn't there something less motivating than telling me that I should be doing something? So yes, I'm working to try to find better ways of helping people do the best thing for their health and meeting them where they are.
I think there is one other thing beyond exercise that is basically a miracle drug, and that's puppies.
Puppies.
If you have puppies around, it cures everything.
No doubt.
It cures everything. Maybe I'll develop. I need to renew my research grant, so maybe I'll throw in some puppy research to complete my portfolio. That's a great idea.
I think you should. Chris and I were interested in trying goat yoga before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So there are ways of like bringing animals into exercise. Maybe that's the way forward. Who knows?
Yeah.
Dr. Olivier Drouin, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, your expertise. If people want to find you and your work online, where would they go?
Good old Twitter is a good place to start. Olivier Drouin, MD. Otherwise, you know, if you're more nerdy and you want to look in more the peer-reviewed publications, good old Google Scholar does the job. My LinkedIn profile is also active.
And your home address is?
You can find me at the hospital once in a while.
Well, Olivier, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.